Information about the world of running, inspiration to fuel passion and excellence, and ideas for making connections and finding community. You're listening to A to Z Running. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the A to Z Running Podcast, where we help runners thrive. I'm Andy.
I am Zach.
This week on the A to Z Running Podcast, we're giving you all the details and insights and extra facts about the U.S. Olympic trials.
Yeah.
It was so fun to watch. So even if you had the opportunity to view them, hope you did, you still will find this episode interesting. So listen on.
We've got history, we've got records, we've got the backstories, not of every single thing, but so much interest. And if you haven't noticed, we're a bit excited.
Just a bit.
Just a bit. And because you love the information we have to share about everything, but you haven't yet subscribed, you need to do that right now. Go to atozrunning.com, click the word follow, and there you will find that we will send you all of the interesting things you're not hearing us talk about. But you also need to subscribe on the podcast and YouTube places so that you can hear the interesting things we are talking about. And if that confused you a bit, don't worry about it. Just do it.
So listener interaction, we love it. It's so fun. This week on Instagram, I had a this or that game. So thanks to all who participated.
I don't know what that is.
Very fun. I got to give Corey a little bit of a hard time for answering that he would prefer sprint over distance events while watching the Olympic trials.
That's
like,
just
what?
Silly.
But you know what?
Sprint.
I got to give him, you know, some props for that because it was exciting, you know, a sprinting event. So to like both is a good thing, but we will only cover today the distance events.
Yeah, well, at the very least, the sprinters have way more personality. So it's a lot of fun to watch them when they win and after they win.
Yeah.
Distance runners, it's like, okay, how many times can you watch someone just lay down on the track and breathe?
So if you're a long-time track nerd or you're a fairly new track nerd, this is a good place for you. You're welcome here.
Well, also, if you haven't noticed, we're a bit stoked about track and field right now. Well, Olympic trials and upcoming games and so much excitement. These are the times that we live for, you know, with like the Olympic round and such.
Being fans of the sport.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, one of the questions that we love asking, and many of you do as well, is what do the very best in the world do? You know, like things like how do they train? What do they do for recovery? Well, since you asked, we have, as you might guess, a recovery expert by the name of Lewis Falland here to enlighten us further. That's right. Lewis from Roll Recovery is back, and he's going to be sharing this time about who uses products like Roll Recovery's custom R8, mm-hmm. where you can, by the way, build your own at rollrecovery.com. And so what Lewis has done here this time is he's going to share who uses these products and do
just
us a favor.
Few of them, but you'll recognize the names he shares.
I hope so, or you're not paying any attention. But do us a favor while you listen and count the number of Olympians Lewis mentions. I'll give you a hint, you're going to need more than one hand to accomplish this task. Let's hear from Lewis.
Well, we know that you are very familiar with the team there in Boulder. The OAC
yes.
team, and I hear
name.
That they have been using Roll Recovery. Would you mind giving us kind of like an inside scoop about how they use the recovery tools from Roll Recovery in their daily lives?
Yeah, well, they pretty much have unlimited access to our product. They're actually headquartered in our building. So right above where I'm currently sitting is the OAC gym, where they have their entire setup there. So they use our product pretty much because it's right there in front of them at any time. So I've seen them use the R4 body roller for certain like strength exercises. We'll talk about that guy in a little bit. The R8 is something that I've found that they like to use, and a lot of other pros like to use very lightly before a workout as like a warm up, because it'll flush blood into your muscles a little easier. Certainly not aggressively. There's science behind that, and they've done a medical study on why it's not beneficial to go super, super deep before a warm up, but it is to do it just a little bit. But then after recovery, like, I mean, I live with one of the OAC members, Leah, my wife, and she has a her own custom R8 as well. And you know, at night watching Netflix and stuff together, we'll just sit there and roll. It's kind of dorky, but it's something we do.
We totally understand.
We do. Recovery parties all the way.
Absolutely. Well, so OAC uses it for sure. We actually have a bunch of other representatives that we're really proud to be working with as well. Can I share some of those?
Yeah, would love
to. I got it. They're too exciting to ignore. So the On Athletics Club, you know, Ollie Hoare, fellow Aussie, Alicia Monson, future queen of distance, you know, Leah Falland. She's all right, you know. And then Joe Klecker, who just hit the Olympic A standard in the 10K. Big names for sure, but their coach, Dathan Ritzenhain, who I understand has been on the podcast before. Emma Coburn, Team Boss, we have a partnership with her using the R8 specifically. Tin Man Elite uses our gear. And then other huge names like Alexi Pappas, Jenny Simpson, Shalane Flanagan, Dina Castor, Meb, Bernard Legat, you know, the Bowerman men and women, like a ton of old and, you know, up and coming big names are using our gear at the moment, which is super exciting.
Thanks again, Lewis. And if you want to recover like an Olympian or future Olympian, head to rollrecovery.com to design your own R8, as well as check out some of their other recovery products. Now, let's talk about track. Okay, so we mentioned last week some of our marathoners recently ran some impressive personal best times. If you recall, Pete was amongst them, and he has been willing to share now a quick reflection on how he was able to achieve these recent successes. So let's hear from Pete.
Hey everyone, Pete here. Zach and Annie asked me to speak a little bit about what I thought my successes during training that led to me running a nice PR at the Charlevoix Marathon. It's been 8 years coming to finally get a PR for the marathon. And working with Zach and Andy, I think a big thing that really helped me was switching over to a time-based runs and effort-based. So like a lot of my long runs were now, instead of 16 and 18 mile long runs like that, were, you know, two and a half hour long runs and being effort, keeping them easy. Doing, you know, my workouts were, you know, steady states and, you know, fartleks, all that stuff. And instead of focusing on the pace, it was more on the effort. And so going into the marathon, I was really comfortable at working at harder efforts and not really focusing on the pace or, you know, the distance, but I could do the time. And so come race day, I was able to really execute. And when I hit miles 18, 20, 22, 24, I was just kept on going and really ran a really strong race and really closed out those last 10K very strong, passing other runners. And had the race of my running career so far, and hopefully I'll have many more as I close in on other race goals. So hopefully I'll have some more success stories coming soon.
Well, there are two things I believe every marathoner wants. First, a second helping at dinner. Second, a strong final 10K in the marathon race. Congrats, Pete. An impressive thing. I don't know about the second helping at dinner, although we did have pizza the night before the race, and I thought that was a great pre-race dinner. But that 10K and just the great experience overall. So, Pete, congrats to you and to everyone else. Certainly, you know, these are the kinds of things that we all aspire towards, so we appreciate that reflection. Now, let's get on. I should probably let Andy transition us. She's just got a great,
you know, it's a packed world of running on the A to Z podcast this week. And why are we track fans? Why do we love this? Because running, if you run, can be elevated by knowing it as a sport and being a fan. And we absolutely love it. So we're going to be talking this week about the U.S. Olympic team trials. Now, there was other stuff going on.
There's a lot going on.
And I was like, really bummed not to be able to share everything that went on this weekend with you, but we will touch on a couple key things. I'm going to actually skip down and talk about those first.
And we'll catch you up, by the way, next week on more of that. We're not going to just ignore some of the other things going on.
I am so inspired and so excited that Alicia Konacek and her sister, Anita, were able to fulfill that goal that we talked about last week. I'm going to link to that episode because if you haven't listened to that goal setting episode, it is so awesome and practical. And Alicia really dives into these goals. And then days later, she fulfills her dream of becoming an Olympian and then also the dream of being able to achieve this with her sister. So congratulations to Konacek sisters competing now for Team Poland in the 3,000 meter steeplechase.
Well, apparently sister Olympians are on the menu this summer because not only in Poland, but also in Great Britain with the sprinting duo, Cindy Ofili, and we've had her on the show in the past, as well as her sister Tiffany Porter, are both going to represent Great Britain. And is it both in the same event? Correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah, in the 100-meter hurdles. And I should mention it's not official yet, but it will be Tuesday evening. But it is almost certain that Cindy will be going because she is qualified. So, yes, they were first and third.
Excellent. Mm-hmm. Exciting times. Well, let's do this. Because we have so much to talk about with U.S. Olympic trials, what we want to do first is just give you kind of like some of the quick takes, some of the interesting moments that aren't necessarily like part of the highlights of the results, but fascinating things.
Yeah.
So, Andy, give us the first one, one of the most exciting.
Oh, yeah. Abby Cooper. Major props to Abby Cooper because she ran an extremely brave and smart. She set herself up for major success, and she had to do some really brave things in order to set herself up. So
she had to jump over a canyon on a motorcycle.
This is almost as hard, I think. So in the 5K Olympic standard prelim, she went after the Olympic standard, which she had not gotten yet. So she soloed an Olympic standard in a prelim.
So she had to run under 15:10. And this is one of those interesting things. There's two paths to qualifying for the Olympics as an American. The first is to have the Olympic standard and finish in the top three in the finals of your event. So in the 5,000 meter, you got to be top three and 15:10 or faster at some point in the qualification window. But then there's a kind of a second nuance, and we're going to get into that a little bit later. That second nuance is super rare, very uncanny, and difficult. So in Abby Cooper's situation, she needed the time and a top three finish. But in the finals, there's no guarantee they're going to run the time, and you really don't want to have to do something like this in a finals. So instead, she picks the prelim as an opportunity to just solo time trial a very impressive 5,000-meter performance and did it, accomplished it.
So that was really exciting. And the fact that she did that and then came back, and we'll talk about it later, but she ended up fourth in a very brave run in that 5K final. So
now we do want to, because we like giving you a little bit of the backstory stuff too. Abby Cooper, who was Abby D'Agostino in her maiden name, she's been here before at the world level, but it was a nasty fall, like collision kind of thing, and tore something. I don't know exactly what it was, but then she like helped the other runner who had fallen up, and they kind of like hobbled together. It was just heart-wrenching. And so then to see her back in this moment and like putting it down, that was impressive.
Yep. Very brave running.
All right. So one of my favorite moments was in the men's 1500 meter semifinals, where Matthew Centrowitz and Cole Hocker, the NCAA champ, you know, Matthew Centrowitz, the legend, they're sprinting down the final 100 of the semis. Clearly they're ahead of the rest of the pack. And it was, you know, you needed to be certain many places, right, to qualify for the final. And they were easily there. And Central keeps looking over at Cole Hocker as they're finishing down the stretch until finally Cole Hocker looks back at him and they were able to share a full solid 10 seconds of uninterrupted eye contact.
It wasn't a full 10 seconds, well, but it probably felt like that.
But it looked like it, and the looks on their faces, so they were just being funny. And reportedly afterwards, these two were kind of giving each other some hard times throughout, and it was good fun. We'll let you know how that ended up in the finals here soon.
Mm-hmm. So This is kind of like a downer, but a fun fact: there were approximately 92 false starts.
No, that's hyperbole.
Oh gosh,
Andy should never read Zach's notes.
No, I should not.
Because so then I have the dramatic reveal. There were at least 115,000 false starts. Oh, goodness. It was incredible. So in one event, and this is actually literal, in one event there were 6 restarts for one of the men's semi or prelims in the hurdles, and that's just 6 restarts, and it was getting to the point where the crowd is booing, not the athletes, they're booing the starters, like, do your job and just start the race. You know, it was crazy. It was really something. One starter did apparently attempt to false start the discus throwers at one point, but later found out that discus throwers don't have a start. So you can't.
Is this a joke?
That's a joke.
Oh, okay. Goodness. So this is a kind of a problem because it's automatic. And it's not actually caught by the eye. And that's why there were so many more false starts than usual, because there was technology in the blocks. Is that correct?
Yeah. So they've got sensors that are supposed to react to pressure changes. So if an athlete's moving before they fire the gun, clearly it was not helping the situation, though.
Right.
So another one here is shoe technology. Apparently one of the weaknesses of the super shoe types of track spike technology is that they fall off really easily. Or at least it seemed to be the case, because so many times athletes were losing shoes or they were like slipping off their heels. You had one in the prelim, Sean McGordy, in the 3,000 meter steeplechase. Wow. Lost his shoe, had to put it back on, and then proceeded to still qualify for finals, but he had to do a lot of extra work for that. In the women's 10,000 meter, it was Elena Tab who lost the end of her shoe off her heel in the first, like, 10 steps.
Oh, no.
Bummer. It's just frustrating. She did, by the way, go on to finish 24th out of 41 competitors. So not bad.
No, but not bad at all.
She was patient. She reeled everyone in about 3 laps time. So she took her time, and it was good. All right. So, yeah, bummer on the shoes, though. A lot of people were losing shoes.
Interesting. So Paul Chelimo's race tactics, we'll get into that later. I don't know why Zach put it in here now, but we're going to talk about Paul Chelimo. We're big fans of Paul Chelimo. He's been on the show, and he had, you know, some race tactics that he used that have garnered some attention.
But on the other side of that, during the race, we discovered that if you want to ensure that Paul Chelimo will unfriend you on Facebook, nudge his arm a bit while you're racing against him. It was bothering him to the point, like, visible frustration.
Yeah. I wouldn't however, like it.
Yes. However, if you're going to do a thing like that to Paul Chelimo, just be prepared to be totally buried by him at the end of the race. Mm. We'll talk about that more in a minute. Mm-hmm. Another one here is, if you run for Bowerman Track Club or On Athletics Club, you have a higher than average chance of being an Olympian this year, because so many from both of those clubs have qualified, and not just in the USA, but have qualified for the Olympics. So when we share the results here, we won't always share like teams and such that people qualify from. But, you know, when you and your teammates are all qualifying from the same club, it's worth comment, mm-hmm. at least.
Very cool. Well, it's been quite a week for some high schoolers. Some not Olympic, but some Olympic dreams coming true. Outside of the Olympic dreams, there have been shoe contracts signed.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and not just high schoolers. Teenagers in general seem to be making headlines. So within the scope of the Olympic trials, like right before the trials started, 3 teenagers that we know of, there may have been more that weren't as prominent, but 3 teenagers that we know of signed new contracts with, you know, major shoe companies. So, you know, hard to resist 6-figure shoe contracts for runners. But when you're 17 years old, like Arian Knighton, and, you know, you're going to skip your senior year of high school competition because, you know, Adidas wants to offer you money and shoes.
And because you're, you know, you're Olympian.
Yeah, there's that in the 200 meters. Or if you're, you know, 18 years old and you're Hobbs Kessler with the new high school record, maybe I'm going to skip running an NCAA to, you know, sign a 6-figure contract with Adidas. And then, of course, there's Athing Mo, who ran her first year of college, broke all the records, and then signed her 6-figure contract with Nike.
Maybe.
We don't know the exact.
We don't know the numbers.
Of course, it's going to be 6 figures.
It's going to be big.
There's no way. Yeah. Okay. Well, so those are 3 of the teenagers among many other successful teens at this time.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, tactics matter. at Championship Racing. And one of the things that's been an interesting conversation point from these trials were the aggressive or edgy tactics you were noticing from runners. Andy mentioned Paul Chelimo was headlining some of these controversial reactions to races. But there were a number of other things, and just kind of like pushing, shoving, nudging. People don't seem to understand this, that it's very common. It's very common, you know, in track and field even, where there might only be 12 athletes in a race. And still there's the nudging, the pushing, because the stakes are high and everything matters. Where you are in the race, your position, and how you're able to move, it matters. And so, yeah, things like that are going to happen. But we had some really crazy instances, like athletes getting pushed off the track in the case of Elliott Pereire, which we mentioned last week. But also a number of those trips and falls that may or may not have been, you know, people wanted to cast blame somewhere. And then there's just like the really savvy racing tactics of, you know, use your body, position yourself in such a way to make it harder for other athletes. Now, I'm going to give you my reaction to that kind of a thing. So the whole point here is, should you, as a runner, intentionally try to kind of like obstruct or, you know, positionally, because you can't like hold your arm out and nudge somebody in a race. My take is, as long as you're not, you know, like flagrantly physically making contact with people and trying to push them around, the concept of positioning is very much a tactic of running, and to use your positioning to influence someone else's ability to beat you, it's just, that's just smart running, in my opinion.
Yeah, as long as there's no physical, like, elbows or obstruction.
I'll give you another just gentle example of this, though, because I mentioned Paul Chelimo getting annoyed from people tapping his arms. That's a strategy. We talked about this quite a bit in college, where if you're, you know, if you're running near other people, a way to just kind of really get under another runner's skin is to just gently bump them occasionally on the arm. Just a little nudge in the elbow. Their elbow's coming back. Just let your hand brush their elbow. And it's not, you're not obstructing them. You're not harming their ability to run, but you're really bugging them. And that can be, well, in the case of Chelimo, a cause for them to bury you, but it doesn't always work out badly for you. Okay, so lots of interesting things. We are going to dive right now into the full results of the distance races, and Andy's got this great combination here for you of some historical facts about the events, as well as who made the Olympic team for the USA and any other kinds of race reflections that are relevant here. So Andy, start us off with, in general, a historical fact about the U.S. Olympic team trials.
Yeah, so we're going to get into some Olympic history, but I wanted to just briefly give you one historical fact about the U.S. Olympic trials, which is that in 1972 is when the U.S. moved from having qualifying meets to having qualifying standards, meaning they had to actually compete at multiple meets in order to qualify for the Olympic Games, whereas now there is a time that qualifies you for the Olympic trials.
It's an interesting, so think about something like college. In college, it's both. You have a combination where, like, you in conference championships, you have to finish at a certain place to be able to compete in regionals. And then at the regional championships, you have to finish, it's like top two. I don't know exactly what it is, but regionals, you finish a certain place to compete at nationals. The way it used to be for USA was only these qualifying meets, and your times didn't really matter. Now, that's for me, that's compelling. Like, the ability to have more significant track meets throughout the year, or races, it doesn't have to be a full meet, but more significant races throughout the year, I really like that. However, there's an accessibility factor here where, like, not everyone can get to these races, and, you know, some are obviously closer and easier for others. And then, you know, the time factor alleviates that a bit, where all you have to do is run a time standard. So you can do it anywhere at any kind of meet. There's still compelling track meets happening because that's, you know, a great place to run a good time. So pros and cons.
Yeah. So now let's get started with the 800 meter run at the U.S. Olympic team trials.
Arguably a sprint, but we'll still include it.
Historical fact. In 1928, women competed in the 800 meter run, but during that event, they were reportedly running to exhaustion, which concerned the public. And I did put this on my Instagram, and many of you were annoyed, as I am, that they were banned from any run over 200 meters because they were worried that it was affecting women's reproductive health and it was causing premature aging.
Well, it's a good thing that we don't care so much about affecting our reproductive health. And I'm kidding.
Yeah. So when that ignorance passed, thank goodness, we have now returned to having the 800 meter run for women. And that was reestablished in Rome in 1960.
Rome.
Mm-hmm. And Olympics. I'm so glad that it was, because it was a thrilling race. Wow. Here in 2021 in the women's 800 meter. It was a stacked field. Five women ran under 159.
Okay.
Amazing, yep. Right?
I don't think that happens anywhere else in the world. That many women running fast from one country.
That'd be a fun fact to return to at some point. Yeah.
Crazy. And the Olympic standard is 159.50. So, all of these women are running faster than the Olympic standard, and that's just something. Mm-hmm. But none of them are running nearly as fast as Ateng Mo.
19-year-old, you've heard us talking on the podcast for a long time. I hope, let us know, if it was more fun for you to watch Ateng Mo because you have been listening to the podcast and getting the inside scoop about her records and things going on. I hope so, because for me, having been tracking this season of hers, I was heightened in expectation. And seeing her in the preliminary rounds running so smooth, jogging, so controlled, it did look like she was jogging
at times. Yeah.
I was really looking forward to this final. I know Zach was too.
Did not disappoint.
It did not. And she ran the world lead and number two of all time in U.S. history of 156.07.
Also a trials record.
Mm-hmm.
That is incredible.
Yeah.
And she put daylight between herself and the rest of the field.
I was actually hoping that they would have gotten more of the race where more of the women were competing at the end stages.
Yeah, the camera's following Ateng Mo and you can't see anyone else because she's going so far ahead.
I mean, it was
a
thing of beauty, but I wish that there was more more camera angles to be able to see the other runners, because it was exciting down for the second and third position. Raven Rogers, the 2019 World Championship silver medalist, made her first Olympic team, getting second in this race. And then American record holder, who we've had on the show, Ajay Wilson, she ended up getting third, but she was boxed in at the end. She had to pass a couple people to make her second Olympic
team.
Her
closing was incredible.
Yeah. It was not easy. It was not just a sprint to the finish. It was a maneuver to the finish.
Speaking of keeping your composure in stressful moments, that's in fact the exact topic of our conversation with Ajay Wilson back on, it was episode 74 of the podcast, in fact. So listen to that and you'll get just that much more clue into how she can establish herself in this kind of a way, because that's not an easy moment in a race.
Right. And I'll also link it at AtoZRunning.com in the show notes.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So a quick note about the men's 800, because we did share the results last week of that race. But just so you're reminded, the men's Olympic team for the USA is going to be Clayton Murphy, who took the victory in a world-leading 143, and then Isaiah Jewett, the NCAA champion, who came back to finish second in the trials, and Bryce Hopple.
Mm-hmm. So, Zach, you have a reflection about the 800-meter run.
Well, foremost, we've got to pay attention to Ateng Mo, because she is something uncommon in terms of middle-distance running, and we're going to see what that means over the course of her career. But I'm really excited to watch her in the games. Everyone keeps talking about, she's young, she's inexperienced. She doesn't look it. She does not race like someone who's inexperienced. Maybe she doesn't make all of these perfect tactical decisions, but neither does Centro.
She hasn't had to
yet. And he's
yet.
The greatest tactician. Yeah. So, no. And I'm not worried about that, because she holds herself well, she competes well, and she makes good decisions.
Yeah.
So what we're going to see then in the Olympics is, if she's on that day and she can make it through the rounds well, I don't see how anyone can beat her. Yeah. I don't see how anyone can beat her at the Olympic level. But we'll find out.
She's a rare talent. I mean, you see people like Simone Biles in gymnastics, and everyone's paying attention to Simone Biles, right? I mean, everyone knows her. You should be paying the same amount of attention to Ateng Mo, in my opinion, because she is rare like Simone Biles.
Well, it would help if Ateng Mo was also on 175,000 commercials.
Yeah, exactly.
During
this is the kind of talent that we really want to pay attention to, because I think Ateng Mo will be talked about in the history books. We'll say, yes, we remember when Ateng Mo, did this and that, because she's doing something extraordinary right now.
Yeah. And all of that said, personality always comes out after the race for these athletes, you know, after the final and the big release where it's like, I did it, especially if they win, you know, that whatever their personality is, it comes out. Interestingly enough, with all of this that we've just said about Athing Mo, she finishes that race and then they put a microphone in her face. It's like, you know, how do you can even think of anything to say? And she's just like cool and calm and just so sincere and not in a, you know, she wasn't arrogant, but she wasn't like putting herself down. She was just there and enjoying it.
Yeah.
And it was amazing for me to say, 19 years old and she's so good. Mm-hmm. All right. I'm excited.
We're fans.
Let's talk about the 1500 meters.
Yes. Historical fact for all of you. The first winner of the 1500 meter run ever, the first time that this event was done, was in 1896 by Edwin Flack of Australia. He was Australia's first Olympian, in fact, and he was the only representative at the Games for Australia. Okay. And women began competing in the 1500 meter run in 1972.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. All right. So talking about women in the 1500 meter run, we shared last week, just very briefly, the Olympic team for the women's race, Ellie Pereire winning the event in a trials record, 3:58, a personal best time. Also, you know, mentioned she got shoved off the track and jumped back on and then pounded everyone for it. she did it figuratively. They apparently were trying to do it literally to her. Corey McGee, Heather McLean rounding out the team. And listen to last week's episode for a little bit more detail.
As
on
Zach
that.
Says that, though, there is no evidence that it was maliciously done. It was kind of a dominoes
yeah,
effect.
Yeah, no, it wasn't. It didn't look malicious at all, but it definitely hampered her. And it was unpleasant for her. So she,
it was a full arm extension off the track.
Get out of my way.
I'm falling down. Well, get out.
Didn't work.
Yep. So men's 1500 meter run was a very exciting race. You probably have seen it covered on social media, but the Olympic trials champion.
We got to do
Cole
it.
Cole Hocker.
All right. So Cole Hocker and Centrowitz going head to head in the semi just set it up perfectly. And Centro staring him down the whole stretch. And you're like, oh, man, what's going to happen in the finals? And it did not disappoint.
No.
It was so good. So Centro's rounding the corner. He's in the lead. He starts hammering it. And Cole was right there within seconds. Like he was just tearing. And he comes by Centro, and you can just see it like on Centro's face where he's like, oh, man, he's getting me. And then right before crossing the line, quiet all you naysayers. Silent all your negative thoughts. Right here, that was Cole Hocker. And so then what made it the best was the look on Centro's face when he did it where it was like he was actually in a halfway between gritting and smiling.
He was smiling.
And you could see in the post-race interview too where it's just like, he got beat. But it was fun.
Yeah, he had a lot of fun. And I think Cole could learn so much from Matthew Centrowitz. So I'm glad that they're on the same Olympic team because Cole Hocker didn't – I'm just going to put it out there. He did not run a tactically great race. He got super boxed in. He was on the rail without like a way to get out. He had to work really hard to get out and then do that final straight kick. And he was like an animal. His arms were like flailing. And, you know, so he's just got this really like – great passion, raw talent, and he could learn some race tactics from our Olympic champion, Matthew Centrowitz.
We'll see. We'll see. So Cole Hocker, 3 NCAA titles this year, and now adding to it a U.S. title. I can't imagine, you know, what is his 7-figure contract offer looking like right now at this point from Nike, but we'll see if he continues running collegiately after this as a freshman. So at 20 years of age, by the way, Cole Hocker now becomes the youngest to win a U.S. Championship since 1970. What's the year? 1974. And then if it really truly happens, so this is the interesting thing. Cole Hocker does not have the time standard for the Olympics. He's not run fast enough to qualify for the Olympics. However, as we mentioned earlier, there's another way you can qualify, which has a lot to do with the world rankings, and he is ranked high enough to qualify in that sense. So now the U.S. Olympic Committee actually can decide whether or not they want to send him. Of course they're going
to
send him.
Well, it's up to their discretion.
Yes,
you know, and there's other countries who have sent, you know, others that have a bigger track record. You know, for instance, Craig Engels, who is number 4 in the list, has the Olympic time standard. So that's why this isn't a sure thing, because we have so many strong 1500 meter runners, including Craig, who was 4th and has the standard already, who's run faster than Cole Hocker. So
We'll
That's
see.
That's where the drama
we'll see.
Lies.
Yeah, the decision will be made in about a week, but it's highly unlikely that they don't select him. You know, look at what he's done this year. But that said, if he does get selected, that'll make him the youngest since 1968 to represent the United States in the 1500.
But Centro was also young when he won his first title.
21
right, so
years
he was a
of
young
age,
guy
winning
too.
Over Bernard Leggett,
wow,
who also was
something.
A legendary
and
miler.
Remember yeah. about Bernard Leggett, and I didn't put this in our history, but he holds both the U.S. and the Kenyan 1500 meter records. Mm-hmm. Currently, he holds both of those. So to beat Bernard Leggett was a big deal for Centro at the age of 21, just like it's a big deal for Cole Hawker to be beating Matthew Centrowitz.
Yeah, very, very mm-hmm. cool. Okay, so if you haven't noticed, Matthew Centrowitz was in second place, which means he's going to the team for his second Olympic Games now as the defending Olympic champion in the 1500 meters, which is always an exciting place to be. And then third place was NCAA record holder in the event, Yared Nuguse, who ran a dominating close as well, just was not quite up to that same speed that those other two were, but really performed well. And yeah. Everyone's been talking about him too. He's got a lot of medal potential as well. Mm-hmm. So we're sending three great milers from the United States to the Olympics.
Oh, it's so exciting. Ah, I love it.
All right, 3,000 meter steeplechase, Andy.
Historical fact, the current format has been contested over varying different distances in every Olympic Games since 1900.
Since the year zero. Wait, when did the Olympics start?
1900. So according to World Athletics. So, and this is the crazy thing about it, is that the women's event was only recently introduced in 2008.
Yes.
So yep. This like long time, you know, very historical event has not been participated in by women until 2008. And now I do want to remind everyone, because I know steeplechase is not one, is not an event that many people have competed in, because it does take a special skill set, which
special
is not
self-loathing. Put yourself through.
So the event contains 28 regular barriers and 7 water pits for a total of 35 jumps over the 3,000 meter distance.
35 jumps with 7 baths included and no extra charge.
Yeah, 12 feet. Have fun to try to watery not get fun. Super wet.
It's good stuff. So in the women's 3,000 meter steeplechase, Andy, I'll let you take this on.
Yeah, with 800 meter to go, there was so much separation with 3 women in front. And those women were Emma Coburn, Courtney Frericks, and Leah Fallon. And it was looking really strong. There was quite a separation behind them. It looked pretty certain, but nothing is certain in the steeplechase. It's such a heartbreaking event at times. Leah Fallon, you know, we are major fans of Leah Fallon, was looking so strong, looking powerful again, had her spark. And she ended up falling after hurdling one of the barriers, and she got right back up. But it was, you know, in an event like this, it's really, really hard to make up the space then again. So, yes, Leah Fallon did fall. She had an amazing rise, but will not be part of the Olympic team this time around. Emma Coburn ran away with the win for this Olympic trials run, and she ended up getting their record.
Trials record.
Of 909.41.
Okay, that's quick.
And the American record holder behind her, Courtney Frericks. So she's only a few seconds behind her, and very strong finish by both of them. And then Val Constein, she sees the third spot position for the Olympic team, running a personal best. Isn't that a dream, running a personal best and getting to go to the Olympics?
Well, the trials tend to be dreams come true or broken hearts.
She's part of the amateur team for Tracksmith, and I'm like, girl, you're not amateur anymore.
Well, we'll see. That's that's the nature of the steeplechase. It's kind of like the obscure event, and that's by no means saying that it's easy, because it's perhaps
not
the most challenging of the distance events, yeah, depending on who you ask and what you're talking about. And so it's really an incredible thing. Now, in the men's 3,000 meter steeplechase, which was then contested the next day, Hillary Bohr took the win in really what was just an impressive run. He just executed very well.
Yeah.
And so, you know, sitting in just the right spot until the last moment when he, you know, took over and dominated.
Yeah.
So an excellent run. And many have been talking about him as one of the United States' best chances at a good performance this year at the Olympic level. And so we'll see that. And then a little bit newer name to the scene in high-level 3,000-meter steeplechase for the U.S. was second place Bernard Keter, who followed Hillary Boer really closely through that finish and had a great race too. And then third place was not a surprise, as we've been watching him perform well at the steeplechase all season, and that was Mason Furlick, who landed his Olympic bid as he had been talking about and hoping for months.
Yeah, and he did. I mean, he was not, though, like one of the top guys the entire time. So, like, Hillary Boer, he was in second place pretty much the whole time. And the leaders changed, but he, like, stayed really comfy in that second spot. But, like, Mason had to pass three men in the last lap to earn his third place position. So, it was a great race to watch. That steeplechase, guys, it's always an exciting one to watch. I think everyone should be thrilled with it because it is such an event of grit. Mm. And you get more and more tired, but the race usually ends up gearing up quite a bit at the end. They are running such fast splits there at the end. In fact, I think, both Hillary Boer and Bernard Keter closed in under 60 seconds.
Wow. Yeah. That's hard to do anytime. That's hard to do in the steeple.
With a water barrier and, four... hurdle barriers. They're not hurdles. They're actual barriers. If you hit them, you fall.
Yes.
they don't fall if you hit them.
So in many instances, the steeplechase is considered to be kind of like the sloppy track event because, you're jumping stuff when you're super tired in a distance race. That's not a good recipe for, positive experiences. And any of us who have run the steeplechase, no one who does the steeple, except for, if you just do it a little bit, I guess. But no one who does the steeple for a protracted period of time gets through it without falling, and generally falling quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you're hitting barriers, you're tripping into the water pit, and then it's like people are landing on your back. It's brutal.
Yeah.
And yet, contested at such a high level, it's really an incredible thing. Mm. So lots there. And what we could say in many ways is that the people who tend to be the most successful are the ones that could just somehow keep their cool and stay collected through all of that sloppiness and frustration and grit.
So you wonder why, like, Emma Coburn likes to get away.
Yeah.
It's because she doesn't want to be caught up in the mix and fall. So that's kind of like, I think, why she likes to do some lead running, is so that she doesn't get tripped up as much.
Yeah. In many ways, you see the steeplechasers tend to prefer to just go out as opposed to other races, just simply to be out of trouble in the jumping. And you see that at very high levels more often in the steeple than you do in other distance races. And it's for that reason. If I can, even if it's harder to run in front by myself, it's safer. And that might be worth it.
Mm-hmm.
5,000 meters.
Yes.
Woo.
Many of us are familiar with this event because we run the 5K on the roads, which is the same as 5,000 meters.
It is not the same. One of them is kilometers, another is meters.
I know, but they're the same distance. Thanks, Zach. So, historical fact, the event is almost the same length as the Dolichos Racen, which is Greek, excuse my Greek, for long
Greek
race. Mm. And that was held at the ancient Olympic Games, introduced in 720 BCE.
Wait a second. How do they know this? That was so long ago. How's there any clear record on it? It was about the same distance as, but, they measure distance in hands and feet connected together with
a
string.
But not every time was it this distance. But they say that sometimes it was this
Someone's
distance.
Guessing that it might have been close to, yes, that's what we call
just
history,
just enjoy the
folks.
History, okay?
All right.
Enjoy it.
All right.
So I can tell you with more certainty the event results of this past weekend, which was in the women's 5K. Elise Cranny, Carissa Schweitzer, Rachel Snyder. We talked about that event back on our last episode. If you want more about that event, go listen to that episode.
Speaking of Bowerman Track Club teammates qualifying for the event together. So Elise Cranny and Carissa Schweitzer are teammates at Bowerman Track Club.
We'll talk more about them in a bit.
Yeah. Well, so this is what happens at American distance running is, the people who rise to the top, they just get tough to beat across the board when they're at this level. And so in the men's 5,000 meter, we had a similar kind of experience. By the way, and the races were a little bit different. The women's 5,000 last week, it was more of like, you know, 2 miles at a very slow, and, you know, they keep saying pedestrian. That's the commentators like to use that phrase.
My PR.
It's relative.
For
yeah, it's relative. It's pedestrian for someone who can run, you know, world class times. And so what happens is in the women's race, it's kind of the classic where the last mile, someone starts ratcheting it up and they just keep accelerating. And it's a war of attrition then, who can last for that whole accelerating final mile. And in that case, those three were the only ones that could stick it out. Abby Cooper was there with them. She was there close.
Right. Oh, I wanted to mention her again.
200
yeah.
to go. She started fading off. Well, she wasn't fading. They just kept accelerating.
But I loved watching it. And this is why we love track, right, guys? Because we can see people really putting themselves out there and testing themselves. And that's what I love about what Abby Cooper did, because she ran that really ballsy solo Olympic standard. And then she comes back and she hangs with these ladies. Yeah. And you see it all over her face, the pain. Oh, and I kept thinking, she's going out the back door. Nope. Abby kept hanging on.
Yep.
And like,
she
it
was there until
the
200
last
to go,
little bit, you know,
go.
Like, yeah. I am just, she's remarkable. So Abby, if you listen to this show or you know Abby, get us in contact. I'd love to talk to her. I really would.
Nice. So in the men's race, a direct contrast, this one is what is more considered to be like championship style racing. That if you ever hear that phrase, what they're referring to is basically the runners, some kind of agreement ahead of time to run super slow for as long as possible.
Mm-hmm. The heat probably
exaggerating about the
in
agreement.
That, right?
It could have been, but this happens almost every time anyway. Notoriously, Paul Chelimo is one who has just been like, I'm not doing that, and just takes off sometimes. And he did it once at the very beginning of the race, and no one ever caught him. And he just ran the whole thing by himself in a championship. But that doesn't usually happen. And in this instance, he didn't do it, and which was kind of surprising to some, because I mentioned he was getting bothered by people in the race and visibly, like, at times he was turning and saying stuff to people like, quit knocking into my elbows. But he still kind of kept his composure
despite it
looked like he might lose it, but then he didn't. And just kind of, you know, stayed in that like slow zone for a long, and it was basically like, it was about 2 laps to go, but really the last lap, and it just was like, bust a move.
Yeah.
Everyone goes crazy.
They were going nuts.
And here's what it comes down to. You can be a great 5,000 meter runner, but if you can't run an stellar 400 meter time at the end of your 5,000 meter, you're not going to win these races.
Yeah.
It's
crazy. And the thing that I love is that Paul Chelimo, because I was actually getting a little nervous for him because, you know, I'm a fan, so I want him to win. So I'm like, oh my goodness, these young guys, they are known for kicking. So is Paul Chelimo, but it's like risky in my opinion, you know?
He was confident.
Yeah. You know, he was confident going in there, and you just saw him turn it on and smoke the young guys. So
it is, yeah. So Kara Goucher said about the 1,500 meters when she was announcing for it, she said that in the 1,500, every miler always believes that they have the best kick. And so as a consequence, everyone thinks they're going to win the race. But in the 5,000 meter, that's not usually the case. Usually the runners who know that they don't have the best kick want to change the race experience so that they don't have to rely on that kick, which means they're going to lose. In this case, no one made the move. No one took the risk. And so it came down to a kicker's race.
Mm-hmm.
And as it would happen, the three with the best kicks, Paul Chelimo takes the win in an absurd 52-second final 400. 52 seconds.
That's nuts.
For the last quarter. And that was enough to win the race.
Yeah.
And if it wasn't, his tactics helped him a little bit. We'll come back to that in a moment, as we were saying earlier. But Grant Fisher and Woody Kincaid, you remember their names from last week. We'll recap your 10,000 in a moment. But from Bowerman Track Club, teammates, these guys, when they start kicking, they just look like a different kind of runner than everybody else. They're just flying, their legs, their arms. And so they did. And second and third place, making themselves 2-time Olympians for these games.
They wouldn't call it 2-time Olympians.
Yes.
2-event Olympians.
One,
yes.
Olympics, 2 events.
Yep.
And both of them really performing well. But here's the kicker. Paul Chelimo. Yep.
Here's the kicker.
Yep. Paul Chelimo, in the last 100, he's moving, but it looks like they're going to gain on him. And so right off his right shoulder is Grant Fisher. Just off Grant Fisher's right shoulder is Woody Kincaid. And both of them are coming up on him. And he can tell because he did not stop looking back. The whole is like, where are they? Where are they? And he sees them coming up on him. So he starts what they call the drift. He starts drifting outside. And so he's slowly moving out of lane one. And as he's doing it, Grant Fisher's so close that he can't go behind him. So he's stuck having to drift with him. And then Woody Kincaid's so close to Grant that he has to drift as well. And what happens is Paul Chelimo just continues slowly drifting out into like lane four, almost lane five. And the guys can't get around him. It was a great move.
Some people hated it.
They're like, he should be disqualified. I'm like, no way. That was savvy. And Grant Fisher, in an interview afterward, people asked him, they're like, what do you think about Paul Chelimo in this edgy move? And he's like, no, man, that's just the way, that's racing.
Yeah.
And it is.
Yeah.
And if you can't get to a point where you can get around them and they can keep edging you out, bummer. Yeah. They outraced you.
Yeah.
All right.
Crazy stuff there, Zachary.
So 10,000 meters.
10,000.
Last event.
Your historical fact. There are 6 men who have won the Olympic title twice.
Wow.
Paavo Nurmi became the very first in 1928 because it's way back. Remember, I'm giving you some good history here.
Yeah, yeah. I know the rest of these names, though.
And he was followed by
Emil Zatopek. Oh, yeah. Legendary. He's the one who made famous the concept of interval training. No one ever did interval training before Emil Zatopek.
Whoa, that's a great fun fact. Oh, yeah. Thanks for adding. You want to read the rest of these names for
me? And then Lasse Wieren, known as the Flying Finn. At one point, someone asked him what drugs he was cheating on, and he said, goat's milk, with a serious face.
Yeah.
Haile Gebrselassie, the first king of distance running.
Yes, I know him, yep.
Of Ethiopia.
Yep.
Kenenisa Bekele,
yes.
The second king of distance running of Ethiopia.
He's still a king.
Both of them, by the way, held at one point like all of the distance world records.
Yeah.
And then, you know, Bekele broke Geb's records and all of that goes on. And then, of course, Mo Farah, the great Brit, who didn't break any records but won all the races.
Mm-hmm. And then 2 women have achieved the feat. Dirartu Tulu. Yeah. She won her second title in 2004. And Tirunesh Dibaba had back-to-back wins in 2008 and 2012.
Tirunesh Dibaba was for a period of time, you just couldn't beat her. It was incredible stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's some fun facts for you all. And now to the Olympic Trials 10,000-meter run. We've talked about that front-runner tactic, and it's a lot less common for distance events, like
especially the 10,000.
10,000 on a hot day with icky conditions.
So Andy, are you making a point here?
I'm making a point that Emily Sisson is a boss because she took this approach in these terribly hot and humid conditions on Saturday. And although there might have been some worry and skepticism at first that she was doing all the work, she then proved her reasoning when she started separating from the field with 2 laps to go, putting 10 seconds in 1/400 from the other 2 ladies, Schweitzer and Munson.
Okay, so I'm going to give you some numbers here so that you understand what happened. First, it was 4 and a half laps into the race when Emily Sisson decided, I'm done with you people, and just went and never looked back.
Yeah.
But she didn't break away from anyone. They stayed with her. Basically the whole time. So she just ran
Krissa
this
and
beast race.
Alicia Munson and Elise Cranny.
Yeah, not everyone stayed with her.
Were with her, yeah.
But many did for a long period of time. And what she essentially did, they were running about 119, 120 per lap, which is, 520 pace, mile pace, for the first 4 laps, all right? That, for these ladies who can run, 5-minute miles for 10,000 meters, that's not much. And they're all feeling good. And so Emily Sisson thinks, I'm done with this and I'm just going to go. She immediately starts cranking down to 5-minute pace, like 115, 114, and just goes 114, 114. She just starts cranking. And then after a while, she starts dropping like a 113 trickles in there. And then late in the race, a 112 trickles in there. And it's like, what is she doing? She just keeps getting faster.
Yeah.
She buried him.
Emily, I'm fangirling about you because I have thought for a long time that Emily Sisson has amazing form and functional strength. She, if you were to look at her, please do, and see how like her hips don't move. Her arms and her legs move. She's super smooth and super strong, like no mechanical flaws. She's just very, very strong. Anyway, Emily, I think it's fabulous.
At no point in the run did she ever look like she was straining.
She never fell apart.
Look like she was straining, even through the line.
It was amazing. Yes.
I think she might have broken a sweat.
Oh, Zach, I didn't tell you this. So Emily wore her husband's. She stole her husband's sunglasses to run.
You know,
race.
Those Gooders were an interesting choice. So
yeah, well, they matched her uniform, and I actually commented because she had said she stole her husband's sunglasses.
Andy does that all the time. I'm sorry. I'm sorry, Emily's husband. It's a terrible thing, isn't it?
So anyway, I told her that she deserved them as a victory gift from her husband, but nope. She says that she does take them all. Then she responded to me and she said, yes, I take them all the time.
Interesting. And I'm that husband right after that race. And I say, nice work, baby. That was incredible. Let me have my glasses back. That's it.
So there's a little fun fact for you. So Sisson won with a new trials
Trials record,
yes,
over Dina Castor's record.
Legendary. Wow.
And so, totally solo.
31:03.
Yep.
Amazing time. Carissa Schweitzer and Alicia Munson had separated with from the field as well with a second and third place finish. Very impressive. And Alicia Munson, we've had her on the podcast before, an amazingly strong athlete, both mentally, emotionally, and physically. Just, she does a really good job of being calm too. She ended up being hospitalized after.
Yeah.
Because she ran this so hard in the heat and she gave it everything she had. Just an amazing show of willpower and strength despite her body shutting down in those hot conditions.
That's
so
something.
If you want to hear more from Alicia, I'm going to put that in the post, and it's episode 69. If you want to cue that up in your podcast.
Great conversation. So on Athletics Club, another one to represent.
Shout out to Dathan for
that's
coaching
right.
Alicia too.
That's right. Bowerman Track Club as well with Carissa. And that's, you know, she qualified in the 5,000 and the 10,000 along with Grant and Woody from her team. So really just quite something for that women's 10,000 meter race. That was incredible. Now the men's race we did talk about last time. So just a quick mention again, it was Woody Kincaid who took the win in a 53 last 400. Okay. And then
53.
Grant Fisher, his teammate, right with him all the way through. And Joe Klecker of On Athletics Club.
Joe Klecker.
Third. So once again, if you didn't notice, as we said earlier, you had a higher than average chance of becoming an Olympian this summer in track and field if you run for either Bowerman Track Club or On Athletics Club.
And they're not telling me to plug this, but you heard earlier about all these athletes who use the role recovery. Remember, On Athletics Club is helped and supported by Roll Recovery. So these athletes from the OAC use these tools.
That's good stuff.
Yeah.
Well, if we can wrap it all up with just a simple final reflection for the U.S. Olympic trials, it's that it's a rare and incredible thing to be able to watch something like, and it's not just USA, but to watch a country's finest come together and put everything on the line, and things happen, you know, dreams come true, but of course hopes die at the same time, and it's, you know, so some of it's heartbreaking, some of it's exciting,
and that's what is really exciting. Sorry to interrupt you, because I just feel like it's so important to put this out here today, because I follow a lot of these runners who didn't make it, who were, you know, out by a few places, who made it, had dreams, and the amazing amount of resilience to disappointment, but also amazing perspectives about why they do this sport and the reason that they choose to put themselves in this vulnerable place going for big dreams. I want to shout out Kendra Chambers, who has been on this podcast before for the 800 meter run, and her reflections on that. We had great reflections from Steph Bruce, reflections from Leah Fallon, who posted. So all these amazing people, these humans who are also incredible athletes, sharing about their experience looking towards this dream. They did all the work and it just wasn't their day. I think that's incredible too.
One of the comments I always make with these kinds of situations, and it's a reflection that we never should forget in sport, which is that those at the very top can't be at the very top if there isn't everyone else there also. you don't get there. And so like in Olympic distance running, the reason why things have been so on the rise is because it's on the rise at all levels. Mm-hmm. And that's the piece where, you know, you don't finish a race like an Olympic. How many people ran in that race and didn't become Olympians? Most of them. But that's not like a, you know, and crushing defeat and I'm, you know, worthless. And that's where these reflections are so valuable from these athletes, where it's like, we're here in this fight, and that part of that is incredible all by itself. But we're also all doing this together. And on that day, those three, they got their dreams to come true, and that's mm-hmm. wonderful. Mm-hmm. And for everyone else, you know,
it still can be a dream come true. You know, like Chanel Price, she said, I was injured. I didn't make an Olympic team. I had another injury, had this happen. Mm-hmm. And then I made it, and I was fifth in the 800 at the Olympic trials.
Yeah.
In a time that was unbelievable to me. And, you know, she ran 158, a really impressive time. So for her, she's like, this is a humongous victory for me. Yes, I would have loved to make the Olympic team, but look how far I've come. Same with Leah Valens-Post. Anyway, I just wanted to share how inspiring it is, because you know what, like I mentioned earlier in the episode, what's great about running is like the human experience and reaching into these deep places and allowing ourselves to have goals, like we mentioned last week with Alicia, naming goals, saying them out loud, being vulnerable, but then going after it with some freedom, knowing that the only thing we can do when we get to that moment when we've done the preparation is our very best. Mm. And when we leave it out there, it's satisfying. And that's a universal experience. We don't need to be going to Olympic trials to be able to seek some of that. And that's what I love about being a track fan. And that's the reason why we emphasize the world of running on this show, is because we can learn so much from each other and so much from the sport when we're able to learn these stories. There's so much triumph of the spirit and of the body and some amazing things that happen. And we love that you like to share that with us. So thank you for listening.
So before Andy breaks down in tears, just remember that not only have we filled you in on the U.S. Olympic team, but next week we'll fill you on some more Olympic teams from other countries. And we'll continue to do this because as the Olympics near, one of the things that makes it most exciting is when we know the story and what's unfolding before us as we watch the events. So we're going to continue to keep you up to date so you know all of that good stuff. And of course, if you're as pumped about running as we are right now, but don't know exactly where to take your training next, we'd love to talk. Check us out at azrunning.com/coaching. Talk to you next week.